Mr. Cheeseman, reel 12. You were talking about the oil system within the vehicles.
Yes. Right. Now, this little fitment on the dashboard, and within reach of the driver, because dashboards could be, in many cases, you had to lean forward, and you couldn't with the storm guard sheets up. This little fitment, as I say, had a cylinder with a piston inside. Of course, with glands and that, it was kept oil tight. And the oil pressure came underneath and pushed the piston up against its spring, pushed the stalk above the piston up out of the cylinder. So are you going along in the dark or with strong guard sheets up? You put your finger out and you'd feel for that stalk. And if you press it down, yes, you've got oil pressure. you know, it seems ridiculous in this day and age, but it was vital because, as I say, oil systems and things, seizing an engine up was quite ordinary there. Now then, talking about the oil, we're in the period before the advent of multi-grade. So, to start with, every spring you had to change from winter grade into summer grade. Every autumn you had to change from summer grade, never mind about what mileage you'd done, you just had to do it. But with another thing about the oil was that it was also before the advent of detergent oil. Now, detergent oil keeps the impurities in your oil in a liquid state. It doesn't turn it into solids. That wasn't the case those days, you see. And so we had an awful lot of sludge being created. And this had to be dealt with. Well, of course, as today, they're dealt with through an oil filter. It was dealt with an old oil filter those days. Now, the old-fashioned ones, you change your oil filter twice a week. Ridiculous. Or if you were really a hard day, change at the end of the day. Now, this is going to happen. Let me try and create for you a word picture. The type of oil filter on these vehicles that I came in contact with. A canister which would carry, we'll say, 2 pints, right? That size canister, pressure canister, by the way. A strong canister. The oil from the oil pump would go into this canister. Now, what's inside this canister? Right. If you can imagine a very, very thin, precision thickness metal, probably 0.002 inch thick, right? A whole sheet of that, and if you stamp out of that discs which look like cart wheels with only 4 spokes. And where the axle of the wheel would go through, that's square. Right? And you've got a rim, 4 spokes, and a hole which is square in the centre. You put it, and you've got a spindle which is square. You fit one of those plates 2 thou thick over the spindle. Then you get another piece of metal which is shaped like a hook, right? And you put that one side of the wheel, another on the other side. Sometimes it's got 4, but we just talk about 2. Then you put another wheel on, and another, I'll call these ploughs, because that's what they were, they would be less than a thou thick. And you carry on like that until you've got a whole cylinder of this interleaved thing there. And what you've got is a filter, the distance between each plate being half a thou thick, right? And it's on a square spindle, so that if you ring and bring it to a handle, you can turn that and turn it right round, can't you? Now, if you hold the ploughs, you're turning the discs round, and the ploughs, anything that's collecting between those plates is ploughed out to the outside. Now, the whole of that is put inside that canister of turning block, right? And then the oil which has filtered is in the centre of these, this disc. That is sent to your engine. So what the driver did, he'd be watching his oil pressure. He's got no slow guard sheets up now. He's watching his oil pressure, and he sees his oil pressure start going down. That means that his filter's getting blocked up. So he just stopped the engine, stop, get out, lift the bonnet, give it a couple of turns, and off you go. But then, of course, you've got traffic to think about, you've got this to think about, you've got that thing, and you can forget about rubbing your oil. So that's a little bit dodgy, isn't it? So the Crossway did this. Instead of having just an oily handle on the top to turn these discs, put a ratchet crank on it. And by means of bell cranks and rods and what have you, connect it to your clutch pedal. So every time you pushed your clutch out, it turned it so far. How about that for magnificence? An automatic oil change.
It must have been extremely uncomfortable and cold to drive in bad weather.
Very, very, very cold indeed. In fact, these storm guard sheets were very little use at all, because with the hood and the storm guard sheet, you're at the bottom of a horizontal filter and funnel where the wind and rain is blowing in your face, and it doesn't matter how many scarves you put round, you're absolutely, that scarf soon became sodden and would trickle down your front. And because the seats were leather and therefore more or less waterproof, that's where the water would gather, and you'd be sitting in a puddle. And I have sat in a block of ice in the winter. I know this seems ridiculous, but I have, really. The whole of my front, even to my vest, has been stiff with ice. You say, oh yeah, well, we were tough in those days, I have to admit. And that's about as far as that's all the other idiosyncrasy. All vehicles in those days, if you're standing, the vehicle is standing at the side of the road, and you're standing on the path, so the near side to you, right, you are, I'm talking about that, the wheel nuts, as far as the wheels the wheel nuts were left hand threaded.
We've got this on another tape.
We have.
Yes, you're talking about this on another tape. Yeah. Can we come back to the way that the companies and the battalion were organised? We've talked about the fighting element in it, the tanks and their crews. Fitters, were fitters in every company or battalion? Or how were they organised?
The fitters, each company had its fitters. I think I can best explain this by jumping right ahead into the desert. Do you mind? Right. A tank battle. By now, of course, we are quite au fait with mobile warfare. And by jingles, there's nothing more mobile than a tank battle in a desert. Put it like this. Supposing our battalion is advancing slowly or swiftly or what have you, westward, all day, going westward all day. And yet, throughout that day, we would be retreating for 2 hours, advancing another hour, going to sight. In other words, it's like a couple of boxers in the ring. Yeah, they're going round each other and what have you, and you could be advancing into your own corner. And still, you know, so it's absolutely mobile. Right. Now then, as regards replenishment of the tanks, well, of course, they would always find a convenient dip in the contours of the desert for a petrol or an ammunition replenishment stop. Great. But Sobs Law would always decree that the tank broke down right in front of the enemy. And that tank was invariably lost, by the way. Finished. But there would be times when we could get to a tank in that position. And Jerry knew he would go. He would see this lorry come and park well away from the tank, and then two or three lads with boxes instead of rifles run to the tank. The tank's broken down. And so he would immediately stop sending AP across and send HE across, because that's the only way to knock out the fitters. And if you can knock the fitters out, if you can knock the petrol lorries out, knock the ammunition lorries out, the battalion out. Okay? They are easy targets, soft targets. So, as I say, so one man would stay with the lorry, whereas the crew that the fitters would stay with the lorry, whilst the minimum amount would go to the tent to sort things out. Now, that lorry the driver would have to watch, and all would come up, exploding the front here. He fell short, start up, and go forward towards it. The next one will go behind him. In other words, you're beating the brackets and go from side to side, and it's surprising, very seldom, that he did get it directed. I can tell you about that later. But, very seldom. Yeah. Now then, so we are repairing the tank, usually slipping clutch, the tracks are overstretched, adjust that. Things that a driver would do, but you would do it. So out you would come. Or anything you would do to that tank to get it mobile as quickly as possible, even if it was a bit of wire. And out you would come. Now then, that was your day. You were alive, you were fully aware during the day. So at night time, when you came into Liga, incidentally, like the old wagon trains, Wild West wagon trains, the tanks on the outside, that's the wagon trailer, and the thin skins, as we call the lorries, on the inside, the women and children, that's how we league it up at night time in the desert. And so we would, the tank crews then, after they replenished the tanks, would get down to them and sleep, well on sleep. But that's when we fitters had the whole of our day's bodging to undo and do proper maintenance work so the tanks were ready for next morning. In other words, long-windedly, all I'm saying is that fitters attached to the air on the tanks ringer didn't get any sleep. Well, you have to have sleep. So the four squadrons now we're talking about, the four squadron fitters, the lorries, were divided into two. Two would be with the air echelon, the tanks. Two would be resting down at the echelon with the supplies. After a week at the very, very most, those two fitters, lorries up the front, would have to be changed because we used to, at the finish, have people coming round with us at 9:10 for the sole purpose of keeping us awake so we get on with our work. After a week, at the very most, we would be changed with the lot of lorries down there. And by the way, this changeover will be done at 9:10. So, you see, whilst there are normal occasions where air company fitters look after the air company tanks and so on like that, there are other times when A and B company look after all the tanks and B and C company look after, that sort of thing. Does that answer your question?
So how many fitters would there be per company battalion?
There would be four fitters and electrician.
And that's for the battalion or the company?
No, that's per company.
Per company. Yeah.
Multiplied by four. But that That was the fitter.
And there would be a fitter truck, presumably.
A fitter, an ordinary fitter, a lorry, yeah. And what we did with that lorry, well, of course, that would come later on.
And presumably you'd have to have all of necessary parts and spares on your lorry, did you?
Yes. The carrying of spares was the biggest bone of contention. It was very, very heavy. You see, because you could not, no way could you do proper maintenance work under action. No way. It was, the best way I can describe it is that we were AA road scouts. Only we were not tanks. We went on the M25. We were up the front. In other words, really, we did what, under normal circumstances, the tank driver would do himself.
And this was multiplied to the battalion and situation,
then, yeah.
And to the brigade with the again.
Brigade, yes.
And where did you get your supplies and parts from? You'd have to replenish them. Where did they come from?
The echelon, all the stuff which not wanted on the voyage was kept in the echelon. Now we talk about what I'm talking about now is the technical side, the supply for all of the food and all that stuff. The text organ would order up his basic squirrels, and we would say we want so and so and so and so and so, and he would send them each night in the night. With the supply column would come up, and they would be supplied. As his stores ran down, he would indent from brigade. And get stuff from there, and brigade, of course, further back, something like that. There were occasions when this sort of thing were bypassed. When the action was not so severe, and he was just fighting during the day, as it were. In fact, that was one occasion when the only time I ever became a tank commander.
Well, we'll come to that, of course. Yes. We don't want to jump too far ahead. So, in the 1930s, as we're talking about, we've outlined the composition of company's battalion. In the manoeuvring and convoy situation, where would, for example, be the fitters in relation to the rest of the column?
The back. That was where you could. It speaks for itself, doesn't it? That anything in front of you would break down, you would eventually catch up with them and say, what's the trouble? By the way, that was very, very nice, because we'd say, look, if there'd be no breakdown, we'd set away at 8 o'clock in the morning, we'd say, right? And, we do like about 10 o'clock tea break, you know? So we'd say to one chap one day and another chap another day, so look, if there'd be no breakdown between now and 10 o'clock, will you break down at 8 o'clock? Yes, I will. We have over tea.
No, you said, I think, that you joined this new unit, 5th RTC, on manoeuvre.
Yes.
How were you received? I mean, there you are, you're looking down on the tents. What happened next?
Right, you are dismounted off the lorry in front of the battalion headquarters. And in line, you become so-and-so, and somebody else and myself, headquarter company. No welcome, the battalion, the line fatigue man was in, I better tell you about the line. All kits, of course, bell tents, all kits laid outside in a row. Now, that's okay when there's sunshine, but it could rain. And there's got to be someone there. You had your ground sheet rolled up in front, so they just unrolled it and put it over there. Had to be someone there. That's the line orderly to do. And he knew everybody and everybody, you know. So he took us to the tent. And that was it. You just twiddle your thumbs. We got there mid-afternoon, actually, and so we just twiddled our thumbs until everybody appeared. They'd come in from her, and we just followed them, mess tins or whatever, you know, coming in to the mess tents. And they're there. I need to give you a plan of this, don't I? Yes. Do it now, or shall I?
Do it now, if we're on, if once we're on the subject.
As I said, the sloping from north to south, so we've got the all along something like that, was these four lines of the four units making the first stand again. At the top, on the top of the hill, were the marquees which had the workshops, the tech stores, and the garden. And in front and the top of each line were the tank parks for each. Coming down from that were the company offices and administration and QM sort of thing there. Then the lines of their tents. Now at the bottom was the cookhouses, sergeant mess, and officers mess. There was a road after that, and the other side of the road were the latrines, and then further down to the right and the bottom of the valley was a huge conglomeration of canvas, Benafi, because it wasn't just a unit, it was a whole brigade. Three sections, the biggest section being when you have your tent on, if you've been camping, the normal tea and bun section. The left hand section was the wet canteen, the beer, whatever. And the other side, which was quite large, was for enter parties. Not Northern enter them, by the way. I don't know whether you should drag them up from, but pretty terrible. Every Saturday night there would be, you know, the
picture. And these were civilian entertainers of dubious merit.
There was more entertainment listening to the lads than the crack there was from the Congress Day. Anyway, that was the setup of the camp. Also down there was the RAOC and their two. I'm now talking before Remy. Right, the RAOC with their big name workshops and the two Stanley tank transporters. That was the layout of the camp. Size, I've no great judge of areas in there. Probably in the regions about 6 acres or something like that. That's what we talk. Now that was the tank battalion. Over the hill were another camp, because you see we were now coming into mobile warfare, which didn't only mean tanks, it meant mobile infantry, mobile guns and what have you, and indeed cooperation with the Air Force. We had two Bristol biplanes, the old, and I had a ride in one of them, right? Camp over the hill. That constituted the first 20 years. Now we're come back to where I left off there, twiddle our thumbs until the lads came back and we had our tea. I never sort of come back from tea when there was an orderly runner came back to me and said, "Hey, pack your kid up, you're not supposed to be here. Come with me, pack your kid up out of the yellow tent," and went up right above the company office marquee, so there was four bell tents there. And that was where headquarters personnel, the old man's tank driver, the transport, headquarter transport, and things like that, and we were an elite alone. And I was actually given, I said, that's your job, given an Austin Cylinder drive after being taught to drive whacking great lorries I've given Austin Cylinder. And I was quite indignant. And I shouldn't have been, because it was a plum job. Everybody was, you know, and it was a brand new one, this, by the way. It had landed the day before I landed. And the reason for this was, and I mentioned this earlier on, that I got high marks by the McKay. Looking down, they said, oh, here's a chap here, he's mechanically minded, so on, like, he's great, we'll have him. So that's how I came to try this. And you see, I had the ear of all the officers I know, especially the battalion technical officer, because that's how I became a fitter, actually. Actually, early on, naturally, I was full of talk then, everybody. When you're driving an officer, you can't stand it with tension, and so it became more and more man-to-man talk. It was accepted, this, by the way. Once you're outside, of course, stand to attention, that's it. And so I was chatting to a mate, and I said, I want to be Italian, rub my hands, sort of thing. My next job now was, I want to become a driver mechanic. What an idea.
What job had you been given?
No job.
Just as a driving for the officers?
Yeah. In other words, a staff car driver. And as I said, I would love to be a driver mechanic. He says, by your records, because it was him that told me how I got there, he says, by your records, you'll want it. He says, but would you like to take some advice? I said, yes, please. He said, don't go in for that. He said, the battalion is allowed so many paid driver mechanics. They can have as many as you like, but there's only so many paid that they can have. After that, you've got to go on a list, and as people leave, time expires and what have you, you come up the top of the list, and by the time you come to the top of the list the way it is now, you'll be time expired, 6 years. He said, you'll never get your trades paid that way. But you know, this is what the technical officer said. He said, nobody likes to be a driver operator. Well, I must tell you what driver operator is. Driver, the spare drivers of the tank, operator, wireless, which was really coming into its own then. He said, nobody likes driver operator. There's bags and bags of opportunities there. Put your name down for that. He said, you'll get just as much mechanical training on it because of the driver side, but you also get the electrical side, he said, which will come in very handy for you. And besides, it's not 1 in 9 a week, it's 1 in 3 a week, so it's not too bad. These figures seem ridiculous there, but that's a very good step up. So that is how I got into the wireless side. However, I'm back with the Austin 7. Now, I was a dog's body, in other words. The technical officer was the one that used it most, but if the RSM wanted to be taken somewhere, I took him. If the second in command of the battalion wanted to go anywhere, I took him. I hesitated there because it wasn't the colonel, he had his own car. But that's the sort of thing. But not only that, we were on manoeuvres on this new sort of thing called mobile warfare, which required umpires to see if things were going right. So I had an umpire occasionally. So what I was seeing was the tactics which won us for the Allied forces, won the desert one. I was seeing them being enacted for the first time. This is history, isn't it? And also, of course, what I was seeing was the the tiny little infant Seventh Armoured Division, the tiny infant desert rats in formation.